Happy St. Patrick's Day to you all.
I have my Kiss Me, I'm Irish button on here, but I'll turn off the little blinky lights so it won't be too distracting for you. And so welcome. And my talk today, for a lot of you, may be review. A lot of you may be new information. A lot of times I give a talk to Linux people and free software people, because what I'm trying to do is bring the arguments about free software from the back of your mind up to the front, so that when you talk with other people, you might be able to give them ideas as to why they should be using free software. So I go back in history a long time. I started programming in 1969. And back in those days, most of the software that we worked on would be what people would call today open source. You got the source code for it. And the reason for that was that the number of computers was relatively small. They were all different types of architectures. IBM had their architecture, Hewlett-Packard had their architecture, Digital, when it came along, had their architecture. And there's a lot of different computer systems built by universities and things like that. There was no common instruction set at all. And the idea of a bus hadn't even been invented yet. So consequently, there was no market that was big enough to really justify putting into binary and packaging up software to be able to sell it as a product. And consequently, when you wanted to have a piece of software written, you basically had to, I have to go up here and see something. You basically made a contract to people as to what you wanted to have written, and then you would have them write it for you. So it's basically software as a service. You would define the types of inputs that you needed or you had and the types of outputs that you needed, and then the steps that you would take to be able to solve that problem. And then you would hire somebody who would program that for you, or perhaps you would program it yourself. A lot of people weren't, quote, professional programmers. That was not the profession they listed on their resume. They were doctors, they were lawyers, they were other people. And basically, they were writing this software because they needed it. Now, today, when we talk about software as a service, a lot of people think, oh, service, that's like flipping hamburgers or something like that. But in reality, the service of writing software is more like the service of a brain surgeon. You know, a brain surgeon doesn't create a product. When you go to them, you don't end up with a second brain bolted onto the first one. You don't have dual processing of your brain, stuff like that. Basically, they fix the brain you've got. But you don't go out to the newspaper and then look for an advertisement that says, I do brain surgery cheap. You know, I used last year's CAT scan machine or something like that. You don't look for that. You look for the best brain surgeon you can, because your brain's very important to you. And consequently, when you're looking for somebody to provide you good computer services, you look for the best person you can find, because you want it to be done in an efficient way, quick way, the best possible way you can for your business. And if you ask any business person, they will tell you that their business is actually more important than their brain. They'll say, take my brain, I don't care, but leave my business because that's important to me. And so they'll pay you good money for good service. Same type of thing with a lawyer. I mean, God knows a lawyer doesn't produce anything, right? But we pay them a lot of money as a service because we value their expertise and they help to try and keep us out of trouble. Now, I was a student back in 1969. I was in university, and back in those days, if you wanted to buy a compiler, you typically had to pay about $100,000 US per copy. And that, of course, was a lot of money for a university student. I didn't really have that in my pocket. To give you an idea as to how much $100,000 was back in those days, my parents bought a house about the same time, three-bedroom house, all brick, on a quarter acre of land, very nice house, for $32,000. So you're talking about three houses worth of software for this compiler. But it was worthwhile because it was going to go on your $2.5 billion computer, and if that compiler could make your computer 10% faster, 10% better, that was really worth the investment. But I couldn't afford one. So there was this organization called DECUS, Digital Equipment Corporation User Society. And IBM had one called Share, and the other computer manufacturers had them. And they had a library of software. And you could purchase a listing of this library of software for $15. You got a nice thick catalog, came, you know, and you start looking through that. You say, oh, I have a PDP-8 or a PDP-11, and here's a nice piece of software in there, maybe a text editor. You say, oh, man, text editor, that cost me $5. But $5 back in those days could buy you 3 pitchers of beer. And so you had this choice, text editor or 3 pitchers of beer. I said, oh, man, you know, that's tough. And I think you can see what direction I went in, especially on St. Patty's Day. So, you know, but this was in effect free software. Now, back in those days, software copyright didn't apply. There was no copyright you could apply to software, nor was there patents. So consequently, this was free software by the very definition, but it was also open because these people wanted you to help them make their software better. And I bought one tape for $5. I got it. And then I went to the school store and I bought more paper tape, fresh paper tape, and I put it through my teletype and duplicated it and sold those to my roommates for $1 a piece. Now, what I was doing was providing the service of making copies of these. First of all, I had taken the risk of ordering the text editor in the first place. If it wasn't any good, I wasn't going to copy it. But then I made copies of the good stuff and sold it to my roommates. So eventually, I had my text editor and my 5 pitchers of beer. So this was all good stuff. And people say, well, why did people write software and give it away? Again, remember, back in those days, it was incredibly hard to sell software because there wasn't any large number of machines, all the same type or anything like that. And people didn't want to have to go through the concept of advertising the software, supporting the software, documenting the software, because those are all hard things to do. And they were not programmers. They were not software people. They were doctors and lawyers and things like that. So they would contribute their software to DECUS. And then maybe if you went to a DECUS meeting, somebody would say, hey, that's a really great piece of software you wrote. You know, let me buy you a beer. Well, that's a really great piece of software you wrote. Let me buy you dinner. Well, that's a really great piece of software you wrote. Let me give you a job. And a lot of these reasons are why we write the software today. Now, a lot of people say, it can't be really good software because these people are not professional programmers. Well, let me remind you of what the difference is between a professional and an amateur. A professional gets paid money for what they do and an amateur doesn't, okay? That's basically the big difference. And so you can have amateur athletes who are just as good or just as good physical shape as professional athletes. I think all you have to do is take a look at American baseball players, you get the idea of what I'm talking about, right? So, you know, you can have a good, very good athlete, somebody who runs faster, can throw further and stuff like that than the so-called professionals. It's just the professionals get paid money for it. And if you're an amateur painter, a lot of times you paint a painting, you don't put it in a closet to hide it. You put it up on the wall in your house for people to see because you're proud of your painting. But you might take it to, you know, an art show and have people that are more experienced than you in painting go along and say, oh yeah, that's good. But if you mix your paints just a little bit differently, then you can have a better sheen on the water. Or if you do this, you have a little bit better perspective. And so you learn from these people. And maybe every once in a while you sell a painting, but even if you don't stop painting because you like to paint. You enjoy painting. And that's why a lot of people write free software. Now, when the microprocessors came out, a lot of this stuff changed dramatically. Because when the Intel microprocessors came out, and systems like the Apple II or the IBM PC came out, all of a sudden, there was this large volume of hardware coming out. And the price of hardware dropped dramatically. Instead of being hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars per processor, we're now down into maybe $13,000 or $15,000 per processor. I still remember back in 1977 when I bought 64K of RAM, of core memory, for only $128,000. Or a few years later when I bought a megabyte of semiconductor memory for VAX11780 and I paid only $23,000 for it. So the price was dropping dramatically. And people said, well, maybe we can manufacture software the same way that we're manufacturing the hardware. Do it one time and stamp it out like cookie cutters. And that's what they did. And so, you know, operating systems like CPM came out from Digital Research, and MS-DOS came out from Microsoft, and Apple came out with their first operating systems, and the PC era came about. Now, before this time, there was no such thing as a computer store, because if there was, you'd have to have an 18-wheel tractor-trailer truck, three-phase power in your house, and a 20-ton air conditioner to use your computer. But now the computer store started up, and people found out that there was large margins to have by selling not only the hardware, but that software over and over and over again. Now, in 1984, there was this guy at MIT, a student by the name of Richard Stallman, and he liked looking at the source code for operating systems, and he liked the fact he could change the code. And he decided that he was going to buck this trend, and he was going to create an entire operating system that was going to be available in source code form. And he called this project the GNU project, because GNU was not Unix. Unix had started out being, in effect, an open source operating system, but over time had been closed down to being binary only. And Richard objected to this. Now, Richard could have done a lot of things. He could have started by writing the kernel of the operating system, which was the part that controls the memory and the CPU and things like that. But that would have been a disaster, because he would have nothing to run on top of it. So instead, he decided to write something almost as complicated, a thing called Emacs, the text editor. Some people say he could have stopped with Emacs, because that, in effect, was an operating system itself. But Emacs was written so it would go across different operating systems. You could get Emacs for VMS and Emacs for Unix and Emacs for a whole range of different operating systems. And what he was showing people was that the most important part was actually having the portability of the user, to be able to have this user use exactly the same functionality across all of the different operating systems. And later on, they developed a set of compiler suites, the GNU compiler suites, starting off with the C language and Fortran, and then breaking out into many, many different types of languages, and also being able to run across many different operating systems. And people started using that. And then a set of utilities and so forth. Now, there were other pieces of software out there. That SendMail, for example, which is one of the largest mail transports, handles more email than probably any other transport. Bind, which is the basis of our DNS system today. University Ingress, and then later on Postgres, which are databases. And finally, the Berkeley software distribution, known as BSD Unix itself. All of these were free, or in effect open source distributions, that created a huge amount of software out there. But it was really the GNU project of the Free Software Foundation that started to really capture people's attention. Now, development was relatively slow by today's standards, because back when I started computing, networking was carrying around a bunch of cards in a box, you know, down the hallway to your friends, and we're sending a piece of paper tape through the postal mail service. And computers were still very expensive. It was very difficult to get the ability to work, of have a bare piece of machinery that you could put an operating system on. And there were fewer books and articles and things like that telling how to create an operating system. But as time went on, a lot of these things began to change. And in 1991, a young university student by the name of Linus Torvalds decided that he wanted to have a complete operating system, a complete distribution. And he started the last real piece that was missing, which was the kernel project. And this eventually became known as Linux. He first wanted to call it Freaks, but thank goodness that didn't go through. And so by 1994, this project had grown enough. There were about 124,000 people using the Linux project by that time. Most of them were developers and things like that. A lot of them were university professors and students and things. It wasn't really commercial or anything. But about 1994, there was enough of a kernel there that people started to create entire distributions of Linux. And distributions like Soft Landing Systems and Yggdrasil, ones that don't exist anymore because they were a little bit too far ahead of the curve. But other ones like Slackware and Red Hat started up, and SUSE and a variety of others, and Debian. And then they became the distributions that most of us call Linux and various people call GNU Linux. And about this time, there was enough that people started using it as on their system as their main system that they were working on, instead of just something that they were developing off to the side. Now, in the period of 1994 to 1995, we were having a disaster in the computer industry. The disaster was that companies like Cray and ECL, makers of supercomputers, were going out of business. And the reason this was a disaster is we absolutely need these computers for doing things. And but it was impossible to make a business out of them, because you would go and you would spend millions and millions and millions of dollars to develop these new supercomputers, and then you would sell five of them because they were so expensive. And two of those would probably go to universities who were never going to pay you anyway, okay? And then one or two of them would go to some government agency that we dare not say their names, all right? And so it really was, they were just going out of business. And two people, Dr. Thomas Sterling and Donald Becker of NASA, came up with the idea of what would happen if we just use commodity-based, inexpensive computer systems and break these problems up so they were massively parallel and be able to create these things that they called Beowulf systems. Now, even they don't know why they picked the name Beowulf. Today, we call them high-performance computing. But they were so successful that today, of the top 500 fastest computers in the world, 98% of them use Linux, because they chose that kernel because it was open source and it fit their needs. And they put on top of it a few libraries called Message Passing Interface, OpenMP, and things like that, that helped them break up their programs. But they use Linux as a kernel. It's the same Linux kernel that I'm using on my notebook over there. Absolutely no difference at all. And this was interesting, too, because it allowed you to have a supercomputer for about 1/40th of the price that you would normally pay for a specially designed supercomputer, or turning it the other way around. You could get a computer that was 40 times more powerful for the same amount of money. And so this was really the first major use of Linux that opened up people's eyes and said, oh my God, this is something that's really fantastic. In 1995, the first 64-bit version of Linux came out. I'm very happy to say that I was helped out with that considerably. I gave Linus Torvalds his first 64-bit system. It was not only a 64-bit system, but it was also a RISC processor, because I wanted him to make sure that the Linux kernel was very, very portable. It's not only a matter of portability, it's a matter of stability. Because if you make your kernel so that it runs across multiple different architectures, then you eliminate what we call Intelisms in the writing of the kernel. And therefore, if the architecture changes underneath, the kernel does not destabilize as much. And this is one of the reasons why the kernel is so stable. Now, I would like to point out that our first 64-bit version of Linux was 11 years before Microsoft made their first truly 64-bit version of Vista. We all know where Vista went. By 1998, all of a sudden, the commercial databases started to take advantage of it. And because it was because of this, and because of the fact that Linux had everything in it necessary to create a real ISP. Okay. How many of you remember the days of ISPs where you would sign up for an ISP because they had a shell account? Yes, that you could log in, you could actually get access to that shell account. It wasn't just a web browser or web server or stuff like that. It was a fact you could log on, you could get access, and you could do things with that. Well, Linux had the ability to do that. The operating system that a lot of ISPs used in that time was actually Solaris. And they would have a Solaris server and stuff like that. And Linux made a perfect replacement for that, except the fact that it was about 1/3 of the price, because you didn't have to buy an expensive Spark system to put it on, and you didn't have to buy the Solaris operating system to put it on. And so all of a sudden, ISPs started using Linux for their work, and then the database vendors started to support it. And one of the first database vendors to support it was Informix. They actually ported it, their database to that, followed quickly by Oracle, Sybase, and the others. In the year 2000, pardon me, two things actually happened. The first thing was that commercial companies like IBM, Hewlett-Packard, and Digital started looking at this as for their commercial customers. This is a major leap forward. This was taking Linux from being the technical or hobbyist platform it had been to being something that people were constantly thinking of as real business. And the second thing that happened was at that time, embedded system people started looking at Linux. Before this date, a lot of embedded systems were proprietary, written by various companies. But the thing that started to kill this type of development of embedded systems was the fact that they started to need to talk to the internet. Creating an internet stack is not an easy thing. Creating an efficient internet stack is definitely not an easy thing. And all of these companies said, whoa, you know, we see a major incremental hit for us. And not only that, but there's all these different processors coming out, ARM chips, Motorola chips, and we have to port our little operating systems to all of these. This is very expensive. Why don't we use Linux? It already has a network stack. It's already multitasking. It's already multi-user. It's already secure. It's already ported to all these different architectures. We can use Linux, and there's no royalty for it. So all of a sudden, a lot of people that have been using closed source proprietary embedded system operating systems started to use Linux. To be fair, there was another reason why they started to use Linux, and that was the fact that the price of memory has started to drop like a rock. And so it was not as important that your entire kernel fit inside of 128 bytes of memory. You had a little bit more space to work with. Now today, every commercial database on the market runs on Linux, as well as a lot of open source ones, MySQL, except one, MSSQL doesn't run for some reason. And every major browser works on Linux, except one, Internet Explorer, for some reason. And every major Office package works on Linux natively, except one, Microsoft Office. And even Microsoft Office works under Wine, so even that could be said to run. But I was talking about natively, so. In fact, if you go out to SourceForge, you'll find out that there's over 340,000 different packages out there supported by 3.4 million developers. And a lot of people say to me, oh, Mad Dog, I've been out there. A lot of these packages, people have abandoned and no longer working on them. Newsflash. Maybe the packages are done. Maybe nobody's working on them because there's nothing left to do. You know, when you sell commercial software, you always want to sell your customers the next version because you want them to buy the license over again. You know, you put in this another little feature and you have to convince them, this is the one you want. No, don't use the old one. Where you say, well, I'm dropping support for the old one. You can't get any patches for that anything anymore. So you have to buy the new one. That's if you want to sell them something. But if the software is done, then you don't do anything to it because all that does is introduce new bugs, right? So some of that software is just done. And people recompile it and put it on different systems over the years, and it's still there. You still can use it. I've been using the same package to format my resume for a quarter of a century. It's done, as far as I'm concerned. My resume is almost done. Well, that's another subject. Okay? So, but there's another thing about these packages, because people look at them and say, oh, Mad Dog, there's, you know, 49,000 CD packages for play CDs out there, and another, you know, all these different packages. How many MPEG-3 players do you need? Well, actually, I don't need any, because I play OGG, but that's a different subject. But sure, there's lots of packages out there to do the same thing. But if you just take one-tenth of all those packages and one-tenth of all those developers, there's still more packages and more developers than any other company has in the face of the earth for software. Now, Microsoft has about 70,000 people working for them. And out of those 70,000 people, 28,000 of them are in sales and marketing and therefore have no useful purpose. Well, the people that are left, not all of them are software developers. There are some people who work in cafeterias. There are some people who paint lines on the driveways. There are guards, security people, stuff like that. There's people to put software in the boxes. There's people to take software out of boxes. There's all sorts of people. And if a company the size of Microsoft, if you really take a look at the number of people that have the word software developer after their name, there's probably about 5,000 to 6,000 of them. Compare that to 10% of 3.4 million. And this is without a lot of different people being on board yet. So expect that numbers will go up. Now, what type of software is out there? Almost any type of software you could ever think about. All categorized and stuff like that. You can search for the software. But the other thing is, you don't need to use all of the software. Let's say you're developing a new piece of software and you say, you know, I'd like to develop a new point of sale terminal software. Do you have to start from the very beginning? No, because there's point of sale software already out there. Maybe you can use it as it comes. Just pull it down and use it. Maybe pull it down and say, I don't like this feature of it. I can change it into something else. And depending on the licensing that's there, you could actually fork the entire thing and create an entirely new piece of point of sale software, but still utilize parts of the old one. Maybe you're creating a new type of search engine. Well, you go out there, look at all the other search software that's out there, or even pieces of software, and use just the pieces. So you don't have to start everything from the beginning. Now, when we talk about openness and freeness and stuff like that, what are we really talking about? Well, it's more than just having the source code for the software. If that was the only thing, then it really isn't that important. However, it's also about having open standards. And open standards are standards which are clearly written, which are agreed upon by a whole bunch of people who know the subject matter and sit there and argue about it for years and days and decades and stuff. One time, Ken Olson, the head of Digital Equipment Corporation, was at a press conference, and somehow the conversation got around to standards. He said, standards are as interesting as a Russian truck, which kind of surprised me working for digital, because we spent a lot of money supporting standards committees and things like that, working on standards. So finally, one day, I asked him about it. He says, you know, he says, I wish I hadn't said that. He says, but that was just a personal thing for me. He said, I'm an engineer, and I hate the nitpicking type of stuff that goes into making standards. I hate doing that. But once the standard has been finalized, as an engineer, I love implementing that standard in the fastest, smallest, most expandable, most scalable, best way. He says, it's just a personal thing of mine that I don't like the nitpicking and arguing that goes forth. He says, thank God it's done. Thanks God somebody apparently likes doing it, but it's just not me. I says, thank you. That was very good. It's an open development model where the customers, the end users, the people that are using the code can actually participate in doing that. I used to work for digital. We had product managers who would go out and talk to customers. You ever play that game sitting around the campfire? You whisper something into somebody's ear. They whisper it to the next person. It goes around and comes back. And that's what happens when customers talk to product managers and product managers talk to engineers, right? Or you ever see the drawing about the swings where, you know, this is what the customer wanted versus what the engineer heard? And yeah, well, that's the same thing, okay? But with an open development model, you all get to talk to each other directly. And you get to see the preliminary stuff coming out. Then you get the director come back and say, hey, I think you're going off the beam here. This isn't what we asked for, okay? Open hardware, well-defined, well-specified hardware. Things that don't use binary blobs that, you know, will work for a certain period of time and they break over time. Or you're trying to have them go to a different piece of hardware and the APIs for the hardware are not supported the same. It's open software, it's open service, and it's open acceptance. Being a meritocracy of people who naturally, the best people rise to the top. And that's very important. How many of you know the chief programmer on Microsoft Office? Wow, this is a rotten poop. Even if I asked this of Windows people, they wouldn't know, because this person is hidden behind Microsoft. They may know the head of the project or something like that, but they don't know the programmers that are in it. But when you have open source code, the names of those people are in there. The mailing list has those people in there. And so they tend to do their best work, because if they do shoddy work, they're left at. You know. When Mark Shuttleworth was starting to design the distribution of Ubuntu, he took his laptop with the Debian mailing list on it and a Debian source code and went down to Antarctica for 6 months. By this time, Mark was a multi-millionaire, so he could afford to go to Antarctica for 6 months. He sat down there with his notebook, and he went through the mailing list, looking at who was giving the best discussions, who did the best coding, who had the best ideas, who was the least argumentative. And when he came back, he said, I want you and you and you and you to come with me and work on Ubuntu. That's how he picked out. No HR person, no resumes. He just looked at the code. Now, open standards means written standards, not just de facto standards, not just I create a program, everybody's using it, therefore it's a standard. I mean, that's not really a standard, okay? A written standard that has specifications and tests to make sure that the code that is written to those specifications actually support them, and maybe even sample code. Now, when we were developing OSF1, which is the Open Software Foundation's code or kernel, that was supposedly the redefinition of what Unix was going to be, they created gazillions of pages of standards, written standards. The problem with that is it's really tedious to read them and then to go back and try and implement something from the beginning. They also create a whole series of test suites. Well, test suites are great. It's just that they always tell you one and one thing. You haven't implemented what you're supposed to. It doesn't tell you what you're supposed to implement. It's just you haven't done it yet. And then finally, they created the most important thing, which was a sample code, so that you could look at the sample code and see how to implement something. And if the sample code was different than the written standard, well, you changed one or the other until they came together. And if the test suites run against the sample code didn't work, well, then you changed one, all three to make them come together. But it's the triumvirate of those three that make a good software standard. Now, we compare that, for example, with ODF, the open document format, versus OOXML, which is the so-called standard from Microsoft for Microsoft Office documents. The last time I looked at OOXML, it was something like 5,600 pages of stuff, which had some descriptions in it that this functionality works the same way as Microsoft Office 3.1, okay, which basically doesn't describe anything. And therefore, OOXML, from my viewpoint, was a completely unimplementable standard. You could not implement an Office format from it because it wasn't specified enough, and there was no real sample code which showed how to do it. So, and finally, from my viewpoint, open standards are most important when they are not covered by software patents. If you create a standard which you have a patent assigned somewhere to that standard, it's unimplementable unless you violate that patent. That, to me, is just driving people to pay you royalties and not really implementing a usable piece of code. MPEG 3 and MPEG 4 and the various other codecs of the movie industry are that way, versus the Ogg Vorbis formats and Ogg Theora and different types of Ogg, which are not covered by any patents that we know of, and they're therefore implementable in a free way. You also want an open development model. You want to be able to see the plans openly, see where people are going to, help to influence that. You want to be able to see what bugs exist. You don't want them to be hidden behind a closed door. It's very important to find out that this thing that you're experiencing is already known as a bug. Somebody's working on it, going to try and fix it or something. Or maybe nobody's working on it. That too tells you something. Okay. Maybe you need to find a workaround. Or maybe you need to hire somebody to go in and fix that bug for you, since you had the bug fixed in a period of time. Now, A lot of people say, well, I can send in bug reports to my manufacturer of closed source code. Well, I will point out that in the end days of Sun Microsystems, they were actually charging people $500 to actually submit a bug to them, because they had so many bugs and they had so many people submitting bugs that just to filter through all of them was costing them money. So they said, well, there's this one mailing list you can send the bug to, and maybe we'll look at it someday. And then there's this other thing where you can submit the bug, but you have to pay $500 to do that because we want to make sure you're serious about the bug. And finally, you should be able to test to see if these things have actually been done. Now, so far we've been talking about open software, but there's now a movement on to have open hardware done too. Have the hardware capabilities, all of them specified, and to be able to make sure that all of those are documented and that all the hardware manuals are available. Now, there's various pieces of hardware that unfortunately the free software community can't really support very well because the hardware documentation people have not documented them for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they're embarrassed about the documentation they have. It's got different things and different comments in there about their own suppliers, and they don't want to have that exposed. Sometimes they feel that they may have violated some other company's patents, and they don't want to document their functionality enough that the other company would find that out. But for whatever reason, they don't document their hardware completely. And that's why whenever I buy new hardware, I try and make sure that all of the different components in there are fully documented so that I know the device drivers in there can be supported for all of time. Now, there are also mega projects which are available. And these are things typically where foundations will come together to give them support, like the Apache Foundation or the Eclipse Foundation or the Linux Foundation for the kernel and parts of Linux itself. And there are projects like GNOME and KDE, MythTV, that are really, really very large projects. And I say that some of these can be a cursing and a blessing and a curse. Some of these projects can really suck you into them, that you've ended up spending all of your time working on these projects because it's just so much fun and there's so much functionality to them. But so you have to make conscious decisions about where you spend your time on these things. Now, a lot of people say to me, Mad Dog, what distribution do you run on your laptop? And I tell them it doesn't make any difference what distribution I run. Number one, because I'm a consultant, I go around, I do consulting jobs for various companies. So if I do a consulting job for Red Hat, I probably will be running Fedora on my notebook. If I do a consulting job for SUSE, I'll probably be running OpenSUSE on my notebook. Okay, so you really can't ask me what I use. You should be using the distribution that's best for yourself. Okay, you should try out several of them. Maybe you should look for what your local user Linux users group is using. If they're all using one type of distribution and you're new to Linux, you might decide to use that distribution yourself so that you can depend on them for a little bit of your support in getting started. But for the most part, all of the distributions utilize a lot of the same software packages. And so if you go from distribution to distribution, it might be because you like a particular feature of one or another, but if eventually you go to a different one, it's not really a big hardship that I've ever seen. So what is the type of stuff? Why should you be using free software in the first place? Well, you know, this is the United States, and I'm very, very proud I live in this country. But it's interesting, when you look back at the Constitution of the United States, it actually, the Constitution, as it was first written, was actually taking 13 small countries and pulling them together. It was kind of like the EU of the United States, right? And before that, each state had their own money, each state had their own militia, each state had their own taxes as you cross the borders and stuff like that. And the founding fathers said, this is crazy. We can't create a country this way. We have to have one currency. We have to eliminate all these tariffs and things like that. But still, there's a certain amount of autonomy that's given to every state. And our states compete with each other. You know, Massachusetts competes with New Hampshire, particularly on sales tax, okay? Liquor prices, cigarette prices, you guys all come up because we're cheap,
We're cheap.
You know, we make a lot of good maple syrup, too. Mm. You guys have a lot of other good stuff. I'll think of it sooner or later. But all of this, you know, this is competition that goes between us. So the thing is, the question you should be asking yourself is, why should you be spending any of your money for software outside of your state? You have people in your state who are programmers who would love to make a living writing software. So why shouldn't you pay your programmers, who are then going to buy local housing, local food, pay local taxes, help support your local schools, rather than sending all of your money out to Redmond, Washington? You know, a long time ago, I found out there's only so much maple syrup that Bill can drink. Okay? And he certainly doesn't like cow tipping. Okay? So there's really nothing that attracts him to New Hampshire. Okay? So I object to keep sending all my money out there or to Silicon Valley. No, I don't want to send my money there either. So I could just pull down software off the net and take all those royalty prices that I would be sending to those two places, and I could pay a local programmer here in Massachusetts or in New Hampshire. Now, I get a second advantage out of that. It's the advantage of creating technology-savvy people in those areas. Because if I don't create interesting jobs that pay people good salaries, they're going to move. And they're going to move to Seattle, Washington, or they're going to move to Silicon Valley. But if I have these people local, I can utilize them for other things. So when some type of new project comes along, I have a base of people I can pull for that are good programmers, that are technologically savvy, that know how to use the software to fix my problems. And this helps to attract new industry to the state also. It's lowering a barrier between the producers and the consumers, so that the producers and the consumers can sit down next to each other and say, this is what I want. Oh, okay. I can do that. This is like we were doing back in 1969, right? The producer and the consumer sat down next to each other to really show what they want to do. And open source is everybody scratching their own itch, but then contributing that back into the greater good. Now, we've been talking about open software in general, but I tend to go towards free software in specific, where it follows the GPL. And I believe that you can make a business off of this if your business is oriented towards the service that you're giving your customers. Now, there's two types of things that people buy. They buy products and they buy services. We went into a little bit of this before. But let's say I live in New York City. I don't want the product of a car. Because the product of a car in New York City is a pain. You have to find a place to park it. You know, then you leave your house. You have to drive downtown. You have to find another place to park it. You know, there's all the traffic. There's the taxi drivers that want to kill you. So I really want the service of transportation. I want to come out of my house, have my stretch limousine sitting there. I get to the back. You know, actually, the driver opens the door for me. I get in the back. I spread all of my papers. I'm reading and doing work while he's driving downtown, dodging the taxi drivers. He gets in front of the building I am, I get out, I go inside, he drives it away, I don't care. It's a service of transportation. A lot of people like cooking food, I don't. I don't like going to the shopping for it, I don't like going to the store. I like the service of food, which is called a restaurant. I go in and say, hello, how are you doing, Mr. Hall? What's your favorite wine tonight? I tell him, they're good, bring it out, it's chilled for me, pour me the wine. I sit there, I order the food, I eat the food, you know, they clean up the dishes, everything is great, I simply pay them for it. Service of food. So a lot of people want the service of software or solution. And it's actually a solution is what you should be selling, because that's what people really want. Okay. Now, another thing about binary-only software that I really hate is every once in a while you simply lose it. I left Digital Equipment Corporation before they were bought by, well, actually after they were bought by Compaq, but before they were bought by Hewlett-Packard. I can tell you, huge amounts of software simply vanished. There were projects that were done and everything like that. These companies had a collision of two projects. They canceled one. The software was gone. There was good technology in that software. It simply disappeared. And the people that were using that particular software were now forced to migrate to some other piece of software simply because the company that owned the software felt that it was not valuable enough to keep it going. It was too small or focused of a market, or it was too hard to sell it, or they had two products that were doing basically the same thing, and they made the business decision to get rid of it. Now, a good example of software that was going out of business was the software Blender. How many people know what Blender is? Good. It's basically a 3D creation, software creation. It's used for creating games. It's used for creating 3D movies and animation. And it was a piece of software that was designed by a bunch of artists. You look at the interface, you say, oh, this is really complex. But once you start to use it, you say, wow, this interface is what an artist wants. But the company that was making it went out of business. The software was about to disappear. And all of a sudden, the customers of it, the small number of customers of it, bought the intellectual property, turned it into an organization, turned it into a free software project, and now Blender is doing better than ever. And not only is it creating the software that creates it, but free movies where you get the intermediate parts of the movie, you can change it to a new ending or new characters and stuff like that. And people like doing that too. Now, a lot of times I talk about software freedom, and a lot of people in this country sometimes have trouble understanding the word freedom. Certainly some of our politicians these days have troubles understanding that word. I won't say which party, probably both. So I often talk about software slavery because people understand slavery a lot better than they understand freedom. Okay, when you're a slave, you're told where to go, who to marry, when to have children, you don't own any property, you know, your master tells you everything. When you're a software slave, the company that produces the software tells you when to upgrade, how many systems to put it on, how many people can use it, and they just find everything about it. That makes you a software slave. Very easy to understand. Now, people say to me, Mad Dog, I love the concept of free software, but I'm not a programmer. You know, I don't know how to program. I can't change this software to meet my needs and stuff like that. Well, folks, you may not have to. Just pull it down off the net the way it exists, and it may be good enough for you. I haven't gone in to change OpenOffice, you know, or I haven't changed any of those. I just use them. And if you're using proprietary software, you've got a proprietary vendor. If you're using free software, there's a developer out there someplace. You can actually talk to them. Oh, there we go. With free software, you can also be a distribution integrator. And you can do that with proprietary software, too. You could be a VAR or consultant. You can get your support from them. You can get your support from a third party. And that third party could be just as good at understanding that free software as the proprietary vendor is at understanding their proprietary software. So in free software, you get support from all these different types of people instead of just the proprietary vendor or even a college student. Give them a couple six packs of beer and you'd be surprised what a college student could do for you. Or even you. So freedom here in this case is the choice that you have of where to get your support. Now, where do you want to spend your money? Well, you can spend your money paying royalties or having a support contract. So I'm going to ask you a question, folks, people in the room. How many of you have ever had a problem with closed source proprietary software? Please raise your hand. How many of you, keep your hands raised, how many of you have ever taken the time to actually turn in a bug report on that software because you paid money for it? How many of you, keep your hands raised, how many of you have ever gotten back a well-worded workaround or bug fix for that problem? Ever. Okay, well, back in the early days you may have, right, because people still counted on that for that. So I ask this question a lot, right, and maybe I have 1,000 business people in the room, and I ask the question a lot, and invariably all the hands in the room go down except for maybe 2 or 3. I say, Mr. Gates, you don't count, okay? But this is the problem, okay? You're spending all the money on that stuff, but you're still not getting the bug fixes. And I used to work for digital. I know how this works. We tried to fix the bugs, but there were too many And if the bug gets fixed, it was typically because the bug happened to exist in a piece of code that we were going to rewrite anyway. So yeah, your bug was fixed in a future release, but it was fixed by accident. And it introduced the fix, introduced new bugs. So you didn't have the old bugs, but you had new bugs. Okay. With open hardware, oh, let me go back for a second. But with free and open source code, you can actually affect the bugs that are fixed. You put your money to fix the bug. You get the bug fixed in the time frame that you want it to have it fixed. And you submit that upstream, and the person's probably happy to get the bug patch. With open hardware, you can choose the services, support, and applications that you want to have. Think non-iPhone. You know, Steve is dead, but I still remember the time that he came out with one of the iPhones and he had the antenna problem. He said, "You're holding the phone wrong." Okay. And before we forget, there's one more part of openness, and that's Creative Commons. Creative Commons is to art what the Free Software Foundation and GPL is to software. Creative Commons allows you to license out your art, whether it be your digital photographs, your paintings, your music, or anything else, so that you maintain control of the intellectual property, but you make it easy for the person to be able to know what they can do with that intellectual property. Do not think that Creative Commons is simply about giving away stuff, because if the person doesn't like the way you license it under Creative Commons, they're still able to come back to you, the copyright holder, and get another type of license available from you to meet their specific needs. But what Creative Commons does is allow people to license their intellectual property freely to cover the most of what people would want to get out of it and what you as a creator would want them to have. Now, we're here, how much time do I have? Okay, we're here at a university, so I always take time when I'm in university to talk about free software in education. A lot of universities feel that the reason that they're here is to teach people how to have a job, get students a job. That is not the reason they're here. The reason that universities are here are to teach people how to think and to teach people how to sift through data and get information and to teach people how to be effective leaders and engineers of the next century. Because if we didn't have that, we would all go back to using sticks to plow the surface of the earth. Because steel takes technology. So, if you're going to be teaching computer science, use free operating system kernels to illustrate what you're doing. Now, Andy Tannenbaum, I've known Andy for about a quarter of a century. Andy Tannenbaum invented the operating system Minix. And it was a nice illustrative operating system for how operating systems work. Unfortunately, there's nobody who uses Minix in the real world. If you use Linux or the BSDs, you find out that you get an operating system that is used by hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people around the world, and that you can actually apply the information that you know, the knowledge you know, after you leave the university. You can also use things like FreeDOS, which is an open source re-implementation of the DOS operating system. You can look at the entire GNU compiler suite. The only existing implementation, full implementation of Ada, is actually a free software project. You can look at the, you can use compatibility tools on top of Microsoft to be able to teach things like shell scripting. But you should use portable languages, not Visual Basic or Visual C. Use the portable languages that come from the GNU compiler suite to teach programming. If you want to teach .NET, for God's sakes, use Mono instead. Mono allows you to write code one time and run it across a variety of different operating systems on top of a .NET framework. And then use Linux, because it's used on one half of all the server systems shipping today, most of the supercomputers in the world, and a lot of the embedded systems. But it's not just computer science we're talking about. If you're teaching engineering and science, there's 3,900 applications out on SourceForge for things like chemistry, astronomy, and all those. You can look, if you're teaching humanities, there's Project Gutenberg, which has over 100,000 out-of-copyright texts, copies of Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn. If you're teaching English as a second language, why make your people buy books when they can get this stuff? And this is searchable electronically, so you can search it and find passages and things like that. If you're teaching business, get them to think about open source projects and open source businesses. How do you make money using open source? Challenge them to do that. K-12, there's lots of software out there for that. And MIT is developing a lot of software. Rice University, a lot of universities, putting their software, their courses up on the net for free so you can learn from them. If you're looking for administrative software, there's a project called SAGU. It's used at 60 different universities. Compare this to having to pay millions of dollars for something like PeopleSoft and still not having it work. There's programs for running libraries. There's content management systems for putting up websites like Drupal, Plone, Joomla, and others. You can introduce free software to your students if you have a university program for giving them inexpensive laptops. Don't pay the Microsoft tax of having that. Use free software instead. And you can create CDs of free software that exists both for Windows and for Linux to be able to make it so that they don't have to worry about paying licensing fees for Microsoft Office or other higher level programs. You should contribute to the open source movement. Make your code GPL whenever possible. There may be times you feel, I just can't do that. That's okay. It's your right. You created the software. You can contribute to the community, whether it be old hardware that you're contributing, documentation, or even new hardware. Buy somebody a video card you would like to see supported. Hire free software developers. If you're hiring a systems administrator for your company, if you're hiring a programmer for your company, why not hire a free software developer? Why hire somebody who's only worked on proprietary software? Why not hire somebody that has experience in both places? If everything is equal, hire the free software programmer. Instigate. You can wait for somebody else to do something, or you can do it yourself. You are in control. You can create a community. You can form a LUG. You can have a mailing list set up. You can start things going. Evangelize about free software. Tell your friends and your neighbors about what you're doing. Write articles, talk at conferences. Pick out a subject that you would like to learn about. You could be just as expert on that particular thing as anybody else. And then you can start to write the articles and talk at the conferences and fly around the world. And I could retire. And then, you know, fight for your rights with regard to copyright, patents, and DRM. And bring two windows to the next Linux conference, and particularly this one. Support your distribution vendors, support your vendors who use free software, and the community in general. We not only have a cute penguin as a mascot, he also drinks beer. I think he's Irish. And in summary, open software is not just about the software itself. It's about openness everywhere, including our government. And just remember, on the internet, nobody knows that you're a dog. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.